So today, speaker is Katrin Schutz from McGill University, and she will tell us about the work she's done on how to use Chime in this secret way. So please, you can start.
Okay, hi everyone. Thanks for coming to my talk virtually. Sorry I couldn't make it. We're just wrapping up the semester now. But yeah, I'm really excited to tell you about why Chime is secretly an axion experiment. And it's an asterisk on the word secretly because it's not a secret anymore. We're telling everyone. So sorry, secret's out. Actually, I also learned from Mark Halpern, who works on Chime, that apparently they did put in a proposal to use Chime to look for ultralight, kind of fuzzy dark matter type of axions, but that's not what I'm going to be focusing on today. So apparently that appeared in some kind of proposal, so I was not privy to that information, but anyway, I'm not going to be focusing on that for the duration of my talk today. Before I get started, I want to just acknowledge the work of a lot of my excellent student collaborators. Here I'm just highlighting five of them. I guess one of them has moved on already to a postdoc at Berkeley, and the other one, Yi-Tian Sun in particular, is the lead author of these works, and he's actually going to come to the dark side, come to Canada for his postdoc. So we're really excited to be welcoming him. Yeah, I think for this audience, I probably don't have to motivate too much the idea of axions, right? But just to make sure we're all on the same page, I'm going to just be using the term axion to mean some kind of particle that has this Lagrangian. So some particle that has this type of coupling to photons. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to be treating this GA gamma gamma parameter as a dimensionful parameter, which I'm just going to treat phenomenologically. So I'm not going to stipulate as to its origins or where it comes from, although there's lots of great UV physics explaining that. So I'm just going to treat this as, the thing I'm constraining. And as I'm sure many of you are very well aware, one of the, key ways that we use this kind of coupling to look for axions is by leveraging this E dot B coupling so that if I have an external magnetic field, I can convert from axions to photons or vice versa through this Primakov-like or inverse Primakov process. And this has been very successfully used in a bunch of different settings, for example, in terrestrial experiments like in resonant cavities or in astrophysical systems where you have a large ambient B field, for example, the magnetospheres of neutron stars would be a really great place to use this coupling. Given this kind of particle, again, I'm pretty sure most of you guys know this, but just a quick recap. This is sort of the landscape. I pulled this off of Kieran O'Hare's GitHub page, and I just like it because it highlights a lot of the different search strategies as well as the different theory work that has gone on in this parameter space of the coupling on the y-axis versus the axion mass. So a bunch of the constraints coming from terrestrial experiments here are shown in red. We have also the astrophysical type of constraints in green. And then these blue regions show different kind of interesting theory regions where axions or axion-like particles can do cool things. Of course, we have this QCD axion band over here, which is also a nice theoretical target. But there's just been a lot of activity going on in this area. And again, this green region showing astrophysical constraints, it accounts for a pretty big chunk of the constraining power on axions. So having said that, I do just want to make a point that I think oftentimes there's this overlooked thing about astrophysics, right? Where, we say, okay, it's ruled out and we move on. But really, I think there's a strong need for complementarity just because of, large astrophysical uncertainties, whether in interpreting observations or perhaps doing modeling or simulation work of astrophysical systems that can be very tricky to account for systematic uncertainties in those cases. And I'll even say that terrestrial searches for axions are not safe from these astrophysical or cosmological uncertainties because in some cosmologies, axions, like let's say as dark matter, will actually form these very compact mini halos. And those tend to survive at an order one fraction until the present day in the Milky Way. And so that means that the terrestrial density of these axions can, in principle, be a lot smaller than the mean galactic density. So, we kind of have these astrophysical uncertainties cropping up all over the place in this previous plot as it pertains to constraints on axions. And so I think it's great to have multiple independent searches using different kinds of instruments or different kinds of astrophysical systems, different systematics, et cetera. That way you can really be certain which parts of the parameter space you're truly constraining. So it's very much in that spirit that I'm going to tell you about actually ways that we can use existing archival data without taking any new data from CHIME to constrain axions. Okay. So that's kind of the spirit of what we're going to do today. So I want to talk about a slightly different process that has been a little bit less widely considered in terms of searching for axions, and that is this process of decay. So axions can decay just by virtue of this Feynman rule over here, and they can decay to two photons spontaneously. Okay, so here I'm just showing my axion and these two decay byproducts, my two photons. In the axion rest frame, each photon has a frequency of half the axion's mass, and the lifetime for this decay is quite long. So if you go to, you know, parts of the parameter space that are, you know, kind of borderline unconstrained, then you end up with this super long axion lifetime that's many, many orders of magnitude older than the age of the universe. So that's kind of indicating for you that in this part of the parameter space, you're probably not going to be able to set very many interesting constraints on axions just by considering their decay. However, that's the spontaneous decay rate. There's also stimulated decay. So what can happen is if I have my axion sitting there, again, we're going to work in the axion rest frame for now. If it's sitting there and I have some photon coming in with the right frequency, and so if the frequency is ma over 2, then it can stimulate a decay. So you end up with that same photon going in the original direction, and then you end up with these two byproduct sort of decay photons coming out. One of these photons is going in the same direction as the incoming photon. They're in the same quantum state. And the other photon is going in the opposite direction in order to conserve energy and momentum. So now what's interesting about this process is that it's actually Bose-enhanced. So if you have more photons in the initial state that have kind of the right frequency, then the odds of having this process occur go up. Okay, so the outcoming flux of this sort of decay is proportional to the differential flux sort of evaluated at that particular frequency. So the more you have going in, the more you have coming out. And in particular, so again, you get one of the photons goes in the same direction as the incoming radiation, but you get this one photon going in the opposite direction, which is again, conserving energy and momentum for you. And I'm going to refer to that photon as the Gegenschein, which is German for, I guess, against shining or opposite shining. And so that's going to be kind of the main focus of my talk is figuring out what happens to this Gegenschein photon over here. So that's what happens with a single axion. Crucially, you know, if we have a lot of axions, let's say if axions are the dark matter and if we're embedded in this halo of axions, then we get to have even a bigger enhancement because we get to integrate along a line of sight if we're looking out in a particular direction. And we can integrate over that line of sight and see the total flux of the decay products. Okay. So now the upshot of all of this discussion is that axions are kind of behaving like an imperfect mirror, imperfect in the sense that, you know, with a regular mirror, right, for every time you shine light on a regular mirror, in an ideal mirror, it's all going to come back. But in this case, you know, we shine light and a little bit of light comes back. So it's kind of like an imperfect mirror. It's also monochromatic, okay, because it's only at this one particular frequency, which is half the axion's rest mass. So with that kind of, you know, TLDR in mind, that means that the name of the game is to try to look for reflections in that axion mirror. So you can go about this in two ways. You can either shoot radiation at this axion mirror and try to wait for the echo to come back to you. And that was an idea that was proposed a few years ago by Artsa and Tsukivi, in this paper that I think really cracked open this whole topic of looking at axion-stimulated decay as a signature. So that's one idea. I think it's technically challenging for a number of reasons, so I'm not going to really focus on it too much today. Instead, I'm going to focus on the second one, which is that we can actually just use pre-existing sources of radiation and try to look for their reflections. And that's something that you can do for free because we have lots and lots of bright sources of astrophysical radiation that we get to use. So just to kind of give a cartoon picture, the scenario I'm going to envision is that we're living in a galaxy. The galaxy is embedded in a galactic halo. I'm going to be treating that as like a Navarro-Frank white profile for my dark matter halo. And it could contain substructure in it, perhaps in the form of axion mini halos, like I mentioned earlier. Those are generally predicted in some axion cosmologies, so we need to consider that possibility. And I'm also going to consider these kinematics where we have some velocity dispersion. So my axion dark matter is like sloshing around in the gravitational potential generated by our galaxy and its halo. So empirical measurements of that dispersion kind of give us something roughly of around 100 kilometers per second near the Earth. And that velocity dispersion is important for two reasons. First of all, it is going to smear our signal spectrally just because of the Doppler effect. So, you know, in the rest frame, right, where you only have this one frequency that you can observe, now if there's some velocity along your line of sight, you're going to smear out the spectrum that you observe. It's going to have now a fractional line width of order 10 to the minus 3. There's also this more non-trivial effect where you get spatial smearing due to transverse velocities, so velocities like perpendicular to the line of sight. So I just want to talk a little bit about that because it's a little bit of geometry. It's not too bad, but it's like it just takes a minute to think about. So let's say I have my axion dark matter clump illustrated over here. This is the Earth. We have the source over here. So the setup I'm envisioning is that the source is like behind us. The light goes past us, hits some dark matter, and the light comes back into our eyes. Okay. So now if this clump of axion dark matter has some velocity dispersion, there's going to be now some opening angle where, you know, the two photons are back to back in their rest frame. But when you boost, you know, we make some kind of boost, now one of them is going to be at some angle. Turns out that that angle is proportional to the velocity dispersion sigma d. So it's kind of like some clump of dark matter is emitting things in some kind of a cone. All right. So this might be concerning because, you know, if you look at this cartoon photon over here, right, that's going off over here. It's not coming towards the Earth. So we're not going to detect it. And you might worry we're going to lose power in terms of our observing signal, but that's not the case. So actually, this effect kind of compensates for itself. So, you know, if you had a clump of axions over here, if everything were perfectly still, right, then the light from the source would go this way, hit this clump, and then go back directly to the source. That's if everything was perfectly still, but it's not perfectly still. So now some of the light is actually going to be coming at this angle again and coming and hitting the Earth. And the light that you lost that was going this way is almost exactly compensated by the light that you gain coming from this way. So these two effects kind of cancel each other out to some degree. And so at the end of the day, what you end up with is an image that is sort of smeared out by this velocity dispersion. You can think of it as a spatial kernel if you want to. So you take this and you convolve it with your point source and you get this kind of smeared image, okay? There's another non-trivial aspect of this geometry that I want to touch upon, and that relates to the degree of spatial smearing that you get. So, you know, again, throwback to like high school geometry. If you think about the law of sines, you can quickly convince yourself that this angle away from the antipodal direction, this sort of sine theta I, you can relate that to this angle over here, which is sine of 2 sigma d, again, sigma d being the velocity dispersion of the dark matter halo, times this ratio over here. So if I'm in some limit where my source is very, very close by to the Earth compared to the source dark matter distance, then this ratio is going to blow up. And so this sine is going to also blow up. That means that sources that are closer to the Earth have more angular smearing. Okay. And when I say close, again, that's relative to the source dark matter distance, which is not a fixed number. Okay. So we're actually integrating over that, as I mentioned a few slides ago. So we're integrating over this column depth. And so this is telling you that in different parts of the column, we're going to get varying degrees to which this image is going to be smeared out. As a quick kind of side note, you know, some folks might wonder, you know, already start to wonder like, okay, what are the optimal, you know, astrophysical sources to look for? And one of the first ones that we thought about was actually the sun, just because the sun is the brightest object in the radio sky. However, it's not a very good source for precisely this reason. The sun is so close to the Earth. And so basically, you know, as soon as you, you know, go even a short distance away from the Earth on kind of galactic scales, like if you go out like 1,000 AU or so, then at that point, your image fills the entire sky. So it's very diffuse and much harder to observe. And you don't get good, like, sort of signal background discrimination. And also, actually, once you fill the entire sky, you know, this effect I talked about where, you know, oh, you lose some signal, but you compensate for it by looking off of the antipodal direction. Well, that compensation effect stops happening once you have filled the sky. So your signal actually goes down precipitously once you start integrating over distances that are further than around 1,000 AU in this case. So for that reason, the sun is actually not such a great source. Okay. There's yet another effect I want you guys to consider briefly, which is the time of flight effects. So this is something that hadn't been considered previously, but it's super important for the kinds of sources that we're ultimately going to care about, which is the following. So if you have some source, okay, it's light leaves the source, it flies over here, it hits this clump of axions, stimulates a decay, the light then flies over to Earth. So if this clump of axions is nearby, that means it's a short time of flight from Earth to the axions and also a short time of flight from the axions to the source. In other words, the light stimulating the decay of these axions passed by the Earth not too long ago. However, once you start going deeper into this column of dark matter that you're integrating over, now you have a longer time of flight. Okay, so now this decay of these axions over here is stimulated by light that passed the Earth a long, long time ago. And you can just keep repeating this argument over and over into deeper and deeper parts of the dark matter column until you get to the point where, you know, as you go to the deepest part of the column, the decay was stimulated by light that passed Earth, basically a galactic light crossing time ago. So 10,000 years ago, that's how long it takes for light to kind of bounce around our galaxy. So in a sense, one way of summarizing this, so it's literally true that when we look in the mirror, we are seeing a younger version of ourselves because of, you know, the fact that light goes around a foot per nanosecond. This is just an extreme version of that principle. Okay. So again, we're using the axions as the mirror and we're going to be ending up looking at sources, what they looked like when they were younger. Okay, so the upshot of this whole discussion is you end up with a bunch of different images coming from this axion decay at different column depths. We're going to basically be looking, you know, at some parts that are, you know, relatively shallow columns. They experience less spatial smearing compared to deeper parts of the column, which experience more spatial smearing. But if you have some time-varying source, then the deeper parts of the column can, in principle, be a lot brighter than the shallower parts of the column. So you have to correspondingly weight these different regions by how bright the source was at the corresponding time in the past. Again, just another kind of like very conceptual thing. It's kind of like, it's not a perfect analogy, but in this image, if we wanted to detect the fact that there's this woman right here, we wouldn't just use the primary image of this woman, we would stack up all of the different reflections in this mirror. And that would be contributing to our ability to say, yes, there is a woman there. Okay, so one thing I want to quickly point out also about this is that we're integrating over a whole column of dark matter. And if you actually compare the kind of typical mass within a column of dark matter and you compare it to the typical mass of one of these compact axion mini halos, we're kind of in a large N limit. So we're in the limit where all of the mass in that column is comprised of like many, many, many of these small mini halos. So we kind of wash out the fact that we have mini halos at all. And because we're getting this kind of broad scale information, we turn out to be quite insensitive to that. So we get the same images regardless, which is kind of nice. It's a nice feature of this search. Okay, so just a couple more things about the signal. So far we've been using this axion mirror to sort of see things that are behind us, you know, like in the classic horror movie sense. He's seeing this, you know, zombie behind him. But you can also see things that are in front of you. So like, for example, this guy is seeing his hand, which is in front of his eyes. He's seeing his hand in the mirror, but with, again, a possibility of a corresponding time delay. So you can have the same kind of setup just with the geometry of the source and the Earth switch. So you can have the source emitting some radiation, kind of going away from the Earth, hitting some cloud of axions and generating these kinds of images that you then would have to stack up and integrate over. And if you work out the geometry for this case, it's quite similar. However, you know, the smearing tends to be a little bit less. The time of flight is still relevant. So the time to go from source to hit the axion and come back to Earth, that's still relevant. So that does still potentially buy you this ability to look at sources when they were younger. And also, if you have a source that's point-like in nature, then the image that you're going to get can be sort of like spatially extended. So even though your source might be kind of bright, the fact that the signal that you get is spatially extended gives you kind of a way to discriminate. There's also this forward shine direction photon that I haven't really focused on too much. You know, that one, you don't get any angular smearing, again, because the photons are going in the same momentum state, right? In order to have the stimulated decay be enhanced. So there's no smearing. There's also no time delay. And so that means this is not a super helpful way of looking for axions in this case. Although, you know, it's still something that you do want to consider if you have a really diffuse source. But if you don't have a diffuse source, then your background, you know, from a bright point source is going to be huge. So it's not going to be very helpful. At this point, I'll also note, I get this question a lot. People often ask me like, oh, can you ever enter into a runaway where, you know, the stimulated decay photons stimulate even more decays? And can you make some kind of a axion laser or something crazy? And the answer is pretty much no, just given the couplings that have already been constrained and given the typical axion densities in the galaxy. So we actually never enter into that regime. Once you generate a stimulated decay photon, that photon kind of never talks to anybody again. It just goes to the Earth or goes to wherever, but it doesn't go on to stimulate more decays. So that's we're kind of in this linear regime. Okay, so having said all of that about the nature of the signal and how to use axions as a mirror, like the optics of axion mirrors, the sort of upshot of that is optimal sources of stimulating radiation should have been the brightest radio sources at some point within the last galactic light crossing time. Again, the galactic light crossing time in our galaxy, it's around 10,000 years, give or take. If it's older or younger than that, then we're not making use of that full column depth that we get to integrate over. So,
it's impossible to have this runaway regime in the galaxy. What about extragalactic sources? Of course, the density of dark matter is lower, but there are bigger distances. So.
Yeah, great question. So a couple of years ago, one of my colleagues, Gonzalo, I don't know if Gonzalo was there, but he wrote this really nice paper showing that you generally don't enter into a runaway like on cosmological scales because of two effects. One of them is the redshifting of the photons. So when you generate these photons from the decay, typically by the time they hit, you know, some more axions, then they will have redshifted to the wrong frequency to stimulate decay. And also you have like plasma blocking kind of effects. So sometimes in these situations, you have a plasma density and you actually can't make those photons. They can't propagate in that medium. So yeah, my colleague Gonzalo, Gonzalo, are you here today?
He's not here.
He's not here today. So, well, yeah, you can ask Gonzalo all about that if you want to. He's like the expert. We've been trying to see if there's some way to generalize that or to, you know, do other things with it. So far, we've come up empty, but I'm happy to chat more if you want. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Great. Okay. So anyway, yep, in the galaxy, we want to look for things that were really bright on sort of 10,000 year timescales. And we're very, you know, lucky that nature has generously provided us with such a source. We're going to be looking primarily at supernova remnants as our sources. Why? because they're very radio bright. So here's kind of a picture of a supernova remnant. You can see it's kind of got this shell that's radiating in radio frequencies due to synchrotron from these like shock accelerated electrons. The brightness of supernova remnants is decreasing steeply as a function of time. So today we observe them as being quite bright, but in the recent past, within the past 10,000 years or so, they were substantially brighter, like orders and orders of magnitude brighter than they are now. The typical age of a supernova remnant is around 10,000 years, coincidentally similar to the light crossing timescale of the Milky Way, very, very useful for us. And also, it turns out the brightness history of these objects can be modeled with a mix of theory and simulation, as well as taking some inputs from empirical observations. So again, this is like a particle seminar. I'm not expecting people to know necessarily a ton about the astrophysics of supernova remnants, but it's a lot like this picture of the Trinity atomic bomb tests. I actually use this as an example in my introductory astrophysics class that I teach. So we do a lot of order of magnitude physics, and Taylor, you know, is one of the high priests of dimensional analysis. So this is a really fun example, especially since everyone has seen the movie Oppenheimer by now. So you can actually do dimensional analysis and like figure out from this picture, like given the fact that there's a timestamp on it and there's a length scale, and you can, you know, just approximate the density of air just to be, you know, what it is in some lab, you can figure out the energy of this explosion. So Taylor actually figured out the yield of this bomb from doing that dimensional analysis. You can do the same thing with supernova remnants. It's pretty cool. You just have to know the density of the interstellar medium. Okay, so that's kind of like the longest phase of evolution gives you this kind of scaling. You also have this initial phase that's ejecta dominated. And you have the radiative phase. Okay, but primarily this is dominating the scaling for much of the lifetime of the supernova remnant. So that's kind of a fun example. And we can then model, so just given like the size and how the surface area is evolving as a function of time, we can also model how the synchrotron radiation flux is evolving as a function of time. So you just open up Rybicki-Lightman radiative transfer book, pretty standard, and you know, you read off you know, these properties for your synchrotron flux, given some electron spectrum that looks like this. This index P, you can just measure it from the radio spectra that you take of these supernova remnants. And then meanwhile, this kind of normalization factor over here, KE, that has to be modeled, and so does the magnetic field over here, B. But again, we can kind of do that, make different assumptions. Here is a plot showing the surface brightness as a function of the size of the supernova remnant. And these basically points correspond to populations of supernova remnants that are observed, and they're all different ages. And then the different solid lines going through, those are the different theory predictions. Different colors correspond to different densities of the interstellar medium, and different textures correspond to different explosion energies. And so we can like make some population statements about these objects. And they, you know, we can get pretty good agreement between what do we observe and, you know, very, very simple modeling. Okay, I don't want to oversimplify the modeling. So, you know, we looked at a bunch of different choices of modeling that, you know, we were worried might affect our results. So, you know, using different scalings for how the B field evolves, or using, you know, different simulations of modeling when the B field even turns on. Okay, all of those things can impact the predicted brightness to some degree, and that's going to have an impact on the predicted signal that we're going to see as well. So just to kind of show the range of, you know, brightness histories that we anticipate being possible, just making different modeling choices, here's what that looks like for our top three brightest supernova remnants. So again, like the different colors correspond to different supernova remnants, the different curves correspond to just different modeling choices. We got all the data for these supernova remnants from SNRCAT, which is maintained by actually Samar Safi Harb at the University of Manitoba, and also from the Green Supernova Catalog. So yeah, in these modeling choices, we're varying a bunch of things like When does the B field turn on? What is the evolution of the B field? How are we modeling the energy evolution of the electrons? Things like that. And you'll also notice that in all of these light curves that I'm drawing, they're all flat at early times. And that's actually not something that most people anticipate being true physically. It's more something that we're doing to kind of just be conservative and cut off the evolution, because at some early times, these descriptions that we're using are going to break down. And we feel like, you know, we don't have good theoretical control over that. We know it's probably going to, you know, keep going up, but we don't feel like we have a good theory uncertainty on that. And so in order to be conservative, we just cut it off. Okay. So that's a conservative modeling choice. And so the upshot of this discussion is that we can do this modeling, we can model the evolution. You know, you can get very different light curves, making conservative assumptions, but you know, there you have it. You have this kind of range of possibilities that you can then feed in into this whole axion story that I was telling you about, and work out the optics. So then doing that, how does this look in the sky? So here's an example of how Vela would look kind of in the antipodal part of the sky. So, you know, if Vela is back there, then this is how we would see Vela in front of our face. Again, folding in all this information about, you know, different stacked images, you know, velocity dispersion, time of flight, all of that information gets folded into that image. And also shown on this image is the FAST beam. So FAST is the 500 meter aperture spherical telescope in China. And actually, we wrote an observing proposal a couple of years back for FAST, and we actually got a 30-hour allocation of time to look in this direction and see if we could observe this image. So far, we have about 20 hours worth of data, so that's still something that we're collecting and analyzing. But you know, we should be releasing that sometime, hopefully within the next year or so. But you know, in the absence of that, here are some kind of forecasts of how well we think we can do with this kind of observation. Again, I'm showing the axion coupling as a function of mass. The different colors, again, correspond to different supernova remnants. And these different panels are showing how our sensitivity to axions changes if we change different modeling assumptions. So here, the colored band corresponds to changing the onset of when the magnetic field gets amplified and turns on, or changing the spectral index, or you know, how the electron energy evolves. The age and distance turn out to not be a huge factor in the uncertainty. Also, the spectral index isn't huge except for W50 because it's very, very poorly measured for that particular supernova remnant. But in general, it's not a huge source of uncertainty. The bigger sources of uncertainty are just the onset of the B field and the electron model. However, even with those big uncertainties, you know, when you fold all of that into our analysis, we still think that FAST could potentially explore interesting axion parameter space. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, you know, you might wonder, okay, well, that's what supernova remnants look like, but what about other astrophysical sources? Could other astrophysical sources do better? This is a question I would get a lot. And the answer is pretty much no, we don't think that there's one that's better. Because again, supernova remnants have this nice coincidence between their, you know, kind of typical timescale and the light crossing timescale of the Milky Way, meaning that we get to integrate over the entire dark matter column and stack up all of that signal. For short duration transients, like an FRB or like a pulsar, the signal kind of decoheres. So, you know, one way of thinking about it is like, if you just take your one pulse from a pulsar, from your FRB, you know, you're kind of then, okay, it goes here to some shallow part of the column, it comes back, you wait a little bit longer, it goes to a deeper part of the column, comes back, you wait even longer, you know, ad nauseum. And so you're kind of taking like that peak brightness of your short duration pulse, and you're smearing it out temporally, which is going to really reduce your signal to noise. So that's not going to be helpful. And so that's kind of like the shorter duration transients. You can also ask, well, what about things that are kind of on all the time, or that are constant sort of on the typical time scale of the light crossing time of the Milky Way? And it turns out that we don't really have any radio point sources that are brighter than local supernova remnants in the first 100 years of evolution. So Cygnus A today is like much brighter than typical supernova remnants. But if you, again, use the fact that we're scaling back these supernova remnants back in time, if you do that, then eventually the supernova remnants do win, okay? So this is just kind of an intuitive argument of why this is the case. My former MSc student, Rohan Kulkarni, they actually did together, you know, with Yitan Sun, they did a pretty comprehensive search looking at different kinds of point sources, also looking at stellar basins, which is a fun idea that I won't go into, looking at different parts of the spectrum, not just radio, but also looking at optical or IR. And they came up empty, but, you know, if you have more ideas, I'm very happy to chat with you. So, okay, so other astrophysical sources are not that likely to do better. What about other telescopes? So, you know, in the earlier part of this talk, I was telling you about CHIME, or sorry, FAST, excuse me. FAST is 500 meter aperture telescope. It's kind of like Arecibo on steroids. It's like this really huge, you know, be all end all of instruments. But, you know, being that we're in Canada, we also have, you know, some other really great instruments at our disposal. Obviously, I'm sure everyone is very familiar with things like CHIME and CORD. Also, we have buy-in on HYRAX. So this is an effort that some of my colleagues here at McGill are working very hard on, including Cynthia Chang. And of course, also we have Square Kilometer Array, which, you know, is still kind of futuristic, but parts of it are going to be built in the next couple of years in phase one. So all of these different telescopes, you know, might give us some complementarity. So what about those? So if we try to compare apples to apples with FAST, it looks like FAST does better kind of over the range of interest. SKA, a lot of people think is going to be like the be-all end-all, but in this particular science application, it's not, because SKA is an imaging interferometer, meaning that it has very, very long baselines to try to resolve very fine angular features on the sky. But Gegenschein images tend to be like several arc minutes across. So from the point of view of the SKA, it might as well be a monopole for all SKA cares. And so interferometers can't see monopoles, right? There's no interference if you are just looking at something that's constant. And so SKA actually resolves out this image and sees nothing. So you can still do stuff with it. You just can't use it in interferometer mode, which is what it's designed for. You can still treat all of the individual elements as just like, you know, individually operating and use the power of root N, but it's still like not as powerful as FAST, particularly at these like masses that are interesting. Meanwhile, you have survey interferometers. So things like CORD or CHIME that are more built to do survey science. So they have a wide field of view and they have a little bit worse angular resolution. So they have shorter baselines. Those interferometers do not resolve out these images. So they actually do surprisingly well in comparison to SKA. But, you know, in terms of just looking at single sources of stimulating radiation, the biggest improvements are likely to come from just better modeling. However, you know, this plot is like an apples to apples comparison of just one supernova remnant. In the case of survey interferometers like CHIME and like CORD, you know, we're not kind of playing on their turf, right? We're not giving home field advantage to those types of instruments because they were optimized to do very, very different science. So what if we tried to gear our search in a little bit more of a home field advantage way for those types of instruments? So in particular, here's kind of an illustration of CHIME and its instantaneous field of view in this stripe right here. And you can see all of the different synthesized beams as these little points. And using the fact that, you know, you just have this big field of view, can you use that to improve your sensitivity to win over these huge dishes pointing at a single source? So to answer that question, you need a few ingredients. You need to kind of first make a map of a wide part of the sky to try to predict what CHIME would see. So the ingredients for that map include things like having a 3D map of the dark matter density and its velocity dispersion, because again, that influences the spatial smearing. We have a pretty good idea of the 3D map of the dark matter density. The velocity dispersion is a little bit more uncertain. We have less of a handle on that. However, we think it's conservative to actually use the local one, because in simulations of galaxies like the Milky Way, the smearing that you would get and the, you know, the velocity dispersion that you would get is actually maximized kind of close to the position where we're at. So if we just take the local one and extrapolate it to different parts of the galaxy, we actually believe that that is conservative to do. So that's what we're going to do, just to be conservative. Great. So what else do you need for this map? Well, we also need a 3D model for galactic synchrotron radiation, which is something I haven't touched on yet in this talk. Because of course, if you look at the radio sky, that is also a very big feature in the radio sky, and it's relevant on very large angular scales. So if we're going to consider something with a wide field of view, we have to understand this as a possible source of simulating radiation. So we did that. We spent a long time trying to figure out what the emissivity density would be for galactic synchrotron radiation in the context of different models. So in order to know that, you need to know things like the B field, you need to know the density of free electrons, you have to have some kind of model for how, you know, it's dependent on the dot product, right? So all of this stuff has to go into it. And the upshot of all of that is you can, you know, plug in your favorite model and you get this sort of like 3D emissivity density that you can then integrate over and to generate the sort of axion-Gegenstein signal that you would see using the optics that I talked about schematically during the first part of my talk. It turns out if you plug in different models for the B field or different models for the electron density, you get the same thing to within 1%, which is kind of amazing. I don't have a good way of accounting for why it's so small, but it's very robust to modeling uncertainties is what we would say. So even though this seems kind of hard, I mean, it's, you know, it's dust and it's magnetic fields and it's all the things that make astronomers go, oh my God, that sounds so hard. It actually turns out to not really matter too much in the end in this particular case, which is great. Great. So then the next ingredient that we need to know is we need to know where all of the supernova remnants are. We need to know their ages, spectral indices, distances, et cetera, if we want to be able to generate the light curves. Now, that's a pretty tall order, okay? So we don't have all of that information for all of the supernova remnants. But one thing that we can do is if we're going to model what this is looking like on a large fraction of the sky, what we can do instead is we can probabilistically generate realizations of these properties of these supernova remnants, where we draw the properties from some empirical distributions. And in particular, you know, for the early phases of supernova remnant evolution, we don't really know how to model it. We also don't have any examples from our galaxy, but we have tons of examples from extragalactic, like very young radio supernova remnants. So we can use that information to empirically determine what's happening at early times. So this is something that, like, when we were studying the single supernova remnant case, we were just like cutting it off. We were like, we don't know how to model this. This is scary. But when we have an ensemble of supernova remnants, we can just draw probabilistically. And also, one thing I'll add to this, there was this paper that came out on the same day as our initial paper of Gegenstein, basically arguing that you might have this supernova graveyard of supernova remnants that, you know, went off and they're too dim for us to see today. However, their emission may still be contributing to the Gegenstein. So I apologize, I forgot to put the reference on here, but that was Chen Sun, Manuel Buenabad, and Gigi Fan did that work. As it pertains to my cartoons over here, it's like having someone who's no longer there or a ghost and looking in the mirror and seeing the image of what that person looked like when they were younger and when they were alive. So, you know, taking all of that together, we need to know, was there a question?
May I ask, your bullet points, like 2, 3, and 4, like what is the rough, 2, 3, and 5, like what is the rough total luminosity, like in each of the components?
I don't know off the top of my head the integrated luminosity over the entire sky. However, if you want to compare the different components, just wait a few slides because I'm going to have a plot showing the different contributions to the signal.
Sure, thanks.
Cool. And if you, and if that's not enough for you, in our paper, we have several appendices where we break it down by contribution. But spoiler alert, supernova remnants are gonna win in the end. Okay. So like I said, we need to have some kind of empirical distribution for these supernova remnants in order to generate probabilistic ensembles of their properties and draw from these. So here they are. Here's what we assumed. It comes from basically looking at observations and then trying to like de-bias them and account for completeness effects or things like that that would bias you. So for example, you can see that the observed supernova remnants are all clustered very close to the sun, but we don't think that that's representative of the true distribution of supernova remnants. So accounting for observational biases, you know, if we think about the graveyard of supernova remnants, they actually have a distribution that's sort of more peaked towards the galactic center as expected. Again, the early parts of the peak luminosity and peak emission time for the early phases of the evolution of supernova remnants, we're getting that from empirical data about radio supernova remnants extragalactically. So this is kind of the prediction for the brightest 10 sources, both from the observed supernova remnants and as well from the graveyard. Okay, these are the early time light curves. And again, we're generating these probabilistically. So within one kind of map that we make of the sky, we draw, for a given supernova remnant, for that one over there, we draw from the distribution. For that one over there, we draw again. We keep drawing for all of the different SNRs across the sky. And then we say, okay, this is our ensemble of supernova remnants that I've generated. But now I can generate more and more ensembles and more realizations. So here's kind of a nice GIF that Yitian made. So it shows kind of the variability you get between different realizations. So here's kind of the sky map of the graveyard supernova remnants. Here's one realization. And now you can kind of see as it cycles through the different realizations, you can see how that map can kind of vary between realizations. So sometimes you have some sources that are brighter or dimmer, just depending. But there's a few features that are kind of common between all of the realizations, and that's the fact that, you know, supernova remnants tend to be concentrated where you have a higher concentration of stars. So they tend to be concentrated very close to the galactic plane. So that's telling you that, you know, if we can see parts of the sky that are close to the galactic plane with these various telescopes, that's going to turn out to be very, very useful for these purposes. Okay, so this is just kind of showing you the variability that we can get between our different draws from these distributions. I also just want to say a final word about comparing different telescopes. So just to try to come up with some kind of figure of merit to figure out which telescope is the most optical, or not optical, the most optimal telescope. Okay, there we go. That's the right word. Optimal telescope for looking for this signal. So if I just you know, compute my signal to noise here is like summing up over all of the pixels in the sky, where here pixels is loosely defined. It's like not typically how people in radio process their data, but we're defining a pixel to be one synthesized beam. Okay. So you sum up all your beams, you have your T signal over your total noise and you square it. So your noise is comprised of a component that comes from the sky. And you also have some receiver noise as well, but actually at low frequencies, the sky background is going to dominate. So we can kind of ignore, for pretty good approximation, we can ignore the receiver temperature. We don't ignore it in our full thing, but just to kind of get a heuristic for how different telescopes compare to one another, I'm just going to ignore it for these purposes. And so then, you know, if you look at this equation and you think about what different things depend on, again, if we ignore the receiver noise of different telescopes, then the stuff in blue really depends on the sky, right? So different parts of the sky have different signal and different background. But then the parts in red are instrument dependent. So those depend more on how people were designing things to optimize for their science. So things like how many polarization channels do we have? You know, that's usually going to be just one or two depending on the instrument, but it's not a huge, huge deal. What's the fractional bandwidth? How long am I observing for? And crucially, how many of these quote unquote pixels do I have? So if we just focus on that part of the signal to noise, where we focus on the parts that are telescope dependent, then you end up with this. So if you just, you know, sum over all your pixels, you end up with something that's proportional to the number of polarizations times the frequency, because this frequency bandwidth, it turns out if you want to do it optimally, you want to have this be proportional to nu. And actually for all of the telescopes we consider, their fractional bandwidth is smaller than this. So it's like we actually downsample, which is great. And then you just have this number of pixels, which you can re-express as the total solid angle of the field of view, instantaneous field of view, divided by the synthesized beam solid angle. So that's just given by lambda squared over the effective area. Lambda squared here being, of course, the wavelength of the light you're looking at. And then this is really closely related to this quantity called the étendue, which, you know, is relevant for telescopes, but also for microscopy. So this is something that tells you, like, how deep and wide do you go kind of at the same time. And if you have a compact array, you can equate the étendue to actually the number of elements in the array. So it's actually a very simple relationship to figure out the relative signal to noise for different telescopes, assuming that they're in a kind of a compact array configuration. So we did this check, and it agreed very, very well with our final results, which again fold into account where the telescopes are on the Earth, what part of the sky do they see, and all this other slop going into it, the receiver noise, all that. It all kind of agrees with what we get in the end, which looks like this. So all of these forecasts assume 5 years of data, which roughly speaking corresponds to the amount of data that's available in the CHIME archival data. You know, if you're like worried, oh, well, what about the duty cycle? Maybe CHIME isn't on all the time. It's not a big deal because the sensitivity to GA gamma gamma only scales like time to the 1/4 power. So it's a very weak scaling with observing time. So that doesn't really make a big difference to this story. So indeed, we see actually CHIME turns out to be very close to the optimal instrument in that frequency range that is relevant for it. And the bands here for all of the different telescopes, the bands actually show the 95% containment of looking at all of the different realizations. So Yitian generated 300 realizations of the sky, again, drawing the properties of the supernova remnants in a probabilistic way. So having done all that work, what we end up finding is that the sensitivity to J gamma gamma is smaller than a factor of 2. Even given these huge variations that you can have. So that's kind of nice. And meanwhile, these light lines up here correspond to the sensitivity that you would have if you didn't even add any supernova remnants into your analysis, and if you just only used galactic synchrotron radiation. So if you wanted to be so conservative and say, I don't know if I trust all the supernova remnant business, but you can still use this part of the signal from the synchrotron radiation in our galaxy. Again, very well established physics, and you can still also get some sensitivity from that as well. It turns out that the best one in terms of sensitivity, just raw sensitivity, is actually Hera, not because it's a better instrument per se than like CHIME, but more so because it's operating at lower frequencies. So just given the frequency scalings of the signal and the noise, over here we expect the signal to noise to scale roughly like new to the 1.5, whereas down here it's like new. So it's, or sorry, new to the 1/2. So it's a much more shallow scaling over here, but you still do get some gains in sensitivity by going down to lower frequencies and lower masses. So that's kind of interesting. And again, I just want to kind of come full circle and say, like, you know, there's other great work that's been done to advance the status of these astrophysical searches for axions. Some of which involve kind of more exotic phenomena. So things that involve a lot of hardcore modeling, and that work is really great. But again, it's really important, I think, to have this complementarity because these systems can be very difficult to model, particularly for compact objects. So I think it's really great that with archival data, we already have this kind of sensitivity. So some of my, you know, collaborators and colleagues who work on Chime are already thinking about how to actually do this analysis. So that I think that that's very exciting. And so with that, I'll just summarize this talk. The takeaways: axion dark matter behaves like a blurry monochromatic mirror, and then you want to look for reflections of things in that mirror to try to detect the presence of the mirror. And for that, we think supernova remnants are really optimal. And we think that existing telescopes might have immediate sensitivity to this, even with just like archival data, despite, you know, astrophysical uncertainties, et cetera. So we think this is kind of exciting, and I'd be happy to take any more questions now. So thanks for listening.
So questions from the room?
Yeah, I have a question. So I didn't quite understand. So in this analysis with Chime, how do you discriminate these Gegenschein from, just unresolved sources?
Yeah, great point. There's two things. One of them is the spatial morphology, because we're predicting what we think that that should look like. And the other one is the spectral features. So most of these things in this part of the spectrum are spectrally smooth, but this is, we're looking for like line emission. So really the spectral differences between signal and background that are allowing us to discriminate, even though the signal is much, much, much fainter than the background, it's kind of like doing a bump hunt on top of a smooth, you know, thing that's might have a large amplitude, but you can still find a bump if you wait long enough.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. And also on the final plot, you have a Hyrax, which seems to be even better. Is it already existing data, or it's some proposal, or what is that?
Great. So Hyrax, I think I have a picture of it in some earlier slide. Let me go back. Yeah. So Hyrax, don't tell Cynthia Chang that I said this, but it's a little bit like Chord, just in the Southern Hemisphere. So this one's located in South Africa. The pathfinder for this one was already built, and the full Hyrax construction is starting next year. I think they only have, it's not the full 1024 number of array elements that I'm plotting in the final plot. That's like kind of where Hyrax is hoping to go. But so for the first array, I can't remember if it's a half of that or a quarter of that. But again, the sensitivity scales like, so signal to noise scales like the number of array elements to the 1/2 power. And the sensitivity to GA gamma gamma, you take the square root of that again. So it's like the number of array elements to the 1/4 power. So if you wanted to like compare, you know, in this final plot, it's too many slides. If you want to compare Hyrax 1024 to a small number of array elements, you just scale it by the number of array elements to the 1/4, roughly speaking.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So on this slide, I just wanted to ask, so it looks like Chord cannot do much better, and that's because your noise is dominated by like foregrounds instead of instrumental properties?
Good question. I think it also has to do with Chord's observing strategy. And I think that they just end up having a slightly smaller field of view, instantaneous field of view. I think that was the main reason driving that.
Okay. Yes.
So maybe I can go back in terms of I think it has a smaller sigma field of view, if I recall correctly. Or omega field of view. I'm a little over caffeinated. It's the end of the semester. My apologies for if I've misspoken.
And sorry, also another question. So you need to have an optimized search for this monochromatic. Is the way they take data already good enough for signal you want to look for, or?
Yeah, great question. So the data that's already been written, we think it is good enough for this search. It's actually nice that the thing that gives us our spectral line width is Doppler broadening, which is the same source of broadening for like the 21 centimeter line just emitted by gas inside of galaxies. So the 21 centimeter back end of this instrument, we think is like optimized for the same science that we want to do, which is like looking at a Doppler shifted spectral line. That's already there. So now all that really remains to be done is to reanalyze that data, but just doing this kind of search.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So I have questions.
We asked about background. So here,
what are the main contributions to your background, like to the noise photons? Are these like all the things that are being like reflected or?
Sorry, I'm hearing a lot of background noise. So I don't know if I caught your whole question, but the parts that I did hear, you were asking about what's the dominant contribution to the noise. Is that correct?
To the noise photons, yeah.
Yeah, good. So it's primarily coming from T-Sky, which is dominated by the galactic synchrotron radiation. So the galactic synchrotron radiation giveth and it taketh away. So it can stimulate, you know, axions to decay, but it's also our main background. That scale is like frequency to the minus 2.5, if I recall correctly. So that's why at low frequencies, this is the one that dominates. At high frequencies, you know, kind of like more towards the 800 megahertz end of chime sort of bandwidth, this one dominates. So this is, I think, around, gosh, like 25 or 30 Kelvin. Don't remember exactly, but yeah, this one is frequency independent. Wow. This one's frequency independent, and this one is like frequency dependent synchrotron radiation.
They ask about extragalactic sources because, in some sense, like you are looking for objects in the same region, like where like the background is right now, because the supernova remnants are also in the disk. Are looking for extragalactic sources leading to this reflection, then they are not in the region where like you get most of your background contribution. Is that correct?
That is correct. However, that fact, like, so we're not actually so dominated by the noise. Like the noise in terms of the sky noise, it kind of differs by like order one or like order 10, maybe in different parts of the galactic plane, or, you know, in plane or off of plane. So that can vary, but it's not a huge factor. The bigger factor is actually the intrinsic brightness. So for extragalactic sources like radio galaxies, again, Cygnus A right now is very, very bright, but it's kind of the timescale for Cygnus A's brightness to vary is much, much longer than the timescale of light crossing in the Milky Way. It's more like order 10 to the 5 years. So if you get to, you know, integrate for the supernova remnant over its whole 10 to the 4 year lifetime, then the thing to compare then is the peak brightness and compare that to the brightness of like Cygnus A or other extragalactic sources, and the supernova remnants win by orders and orders of magnitude, which more than compensates for the fact that the sky noise is worse in the galactic plane. Yeah. But, you know, more quantitatively, if you want to, you know, look at this in our paper, in the appendix, we actually also have forecasts of, you know, if you only looked at extragalactic radio galaxies or point sources, then, you know, what you would see is that, you know, that kind of lives up here. So that's way, way, way less sensitivity than what you would get even from just the galactic synchrotron radiation itself.
From one source or from all the sources?
All the sources. Yep. So we tried to kind of just throw the kitchen sink at this for this iteration, because when we were doing the whole sky, right, it's like, well, if we're doing the whole sky, we want all the sources and we want to make kind of an all sky map. So yeah, we really tried to look for every little bit of signal that we could and scratch and claw our way to having better signal to noise. But yeah, supernova remnants ended up winning again.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Questions from Zoom? Okay, so if there are no questions from Zoom, we can thank the speaker for the talk.
Thank you.